I will call the meeting, the unofficial meeting, to order. And since this is not an official meeting, but we do have the minutes, which we can't officially approve.
Can I not move the minutes? We're not going to approve.
But you, that was the omnibus, or as Mike Yarles used to say, the ominous.
Yeah, thank you.
Health and Human Services bill. And so you can look at those, but we can't really approve them today. A couple of things. The DFL researcher is now back full-time, Leah Montgomery. Welcome back. And we have a new research person, Jamie Olson, who's replacing Amy Cleveland?
Emily
Cleveland, yeah. So, who is now... So, welcome to the committee, and Leah, welcome back.
Good to meet you.
So, we're going to start with the update on the state improvement model grants that we received from the federal government. We applied for, and Commissioner Jessen and Commissioner Ellinger, you want to come up and. And first of all, tell us how many states got these kind of grants.
Mr. Chair, Lucinda Jessen, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Services. We were one of six states that received what they call testing grants, Mr. Chair. Shall I begin?
Yeah, go ahead, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you. It's good to be here, Mr. Chair, members, with all of you. Happy New Year. Commissioner Ellinger and I thought we'd just give you an overview of our SIM grant and really how we think that will help continue to transform healthcare here in the state of Minnesota. This is the Healthcare is More Than a Website presentation, Mr. Chair. So thank you for the opportunity. So we're going to start with some basics about what is the Minnesota Accountable Health Model. CMS, through its Innovation Center, gave states the opportunity to say, look, come to us with a whole statewide plan about how you're going to move your state forward to have better health outcomes, bend the cost curve, better patient experience. And if your state can come together and ask for funding to create kind of a new or refined model that we think may be replicable. I struggle with that word, Mr. Chair, sometimes. But that if it succeeds, we could use in other states, then we're going to give, we have money, we will give to you. You know, in a number of states, other states just applied for what they call design. You know, give us, you know, $1 million to study this and bring everyone together. And when Commissioner Ellinger and I, because this has really been a joint effort between our two departments, brought together a lot of our stakeholders, you know, community members, to say, should we just apply for kind of a design, you know, one of these planning grants, or should we just say, let's just ask, let's go for the total picture. We only had 6 weeks to put this grant application together. And I think so many people in our community said, look, we are done. We really want to move ahead. We think we have a pathway here in Minnesota that's been bought into by a lot of our community. Let's just go for it. And that's what we did. As I said, this is part of the monies we applied for from the Innovation Center. And we needed to show them that we had a comprehensive approach in our state. So this isn't just state government. This is really statewide to try and continue to transform. And I say continue because we've, of course, done so much in transformation here in Minnesota. But take that next big step. And it had to be through innovative payment models and new service delivery models that we could show would both lower costs while improving quality of care. As I said, this is really a joint effort between our departments. We could apply for up to $60 million over 3 years. We did apply for, I think, wasn't it, at 56. We got $45 million. And the five other states that received these, and they were each state, and we've talked to them a lot, had slightly different models. Because I think HHS was looking for different approaches. So Arkansas, for an example, is a state that said we want to, you know, look at, you know, bundles and episodes of care in healthcare homes. Maine was another state, Massachusetts, Oregon, and Vermont. So we, our first, the first part of this was basically a 6-month planning grant, and then a three-year testing period and three-year grant with a lot of evaluation built into it. As I said, I think one of the reasons we got this grant and that we're able to say, look, we don't want to plan anymore, we just want to move forward as a state, is because of the strong foundation our state has that so many of you all on a bipartisan basis have been part of building. So we already had in place Medicaid ACOs. We were able to say to CMS, we have 100,000 Medicaid enrollees that are now just starting to be served in a new model where instead of just paying providers to do more, we're changing the incentives so that the incentives are better quality and bending the cost curve. We have healthcare homes coming out of our 2008 bipartisan reforms, our statewide health improvement program, with a lot of strong collaborative relationships across our state, standardized quality measurement that most states don't have, an e-health initiative, and community care teams were something that we'd already started. And these are just some examples of what I think is really a strong foundation for further reform in our state. But I think we also know if we want to move forward, we have some cracks in that foundation. And, you know, once again, it's not a comprehensive list, but we all know that we have health disparities that we totally need to address. We also know that if we really want to move forward in reform, that means being able to get data, to analyze that data, because if we really want to change outcomes in coordinated care, we have to figure out what's happening to the patients, and that's a challenge. That access to real-time clinical data, to be able to share that across. If we want to have coordinated care, then we need to be able to share that in a secure but appropriate way. We need to be able to analyze it. And that we also know that if you think about it, kind of we had three or four, actually, of our large provider organizations in our state that were some of the pioneer Medicare ACOs. But we also want to, we cannot leave out, and we need to be able to include smaller providers, rural providers, independent providers, and we know that there's startup costs in any new venture, so we really, and that those were keeping some smaller rural providers out of some of these innovative models unless they're part of consolidation. So we know that moving forward, those were some of the cracks. So, and I'm just going to kind of quickly go through this, but obviously, Mr. Chair, members, we'll have time at the end for questions or any time someone wants to jump in. And but so our vision overall, and when I say our, once again, I think this was a very much a community vision, and we had so many letters of support for this, you know, from providers, from plans, for community organizations, really across the board. But our vision was that every patient in Minnesota gets that coordinated, patient-centered primary care. So primary care is at the center of this. The providers are accountable for the care based not just based partly on cost performance measures, but also on quality and patient experience. As I said, we need to change the incentives moving forward for providers. But that those incentives aren't just changed in our public programs. That where we can, and this is a really important part of it, Mr. Chair, members, is that we're aligning these new payment structures across payers. So the providers aren't in that situation. It's like, okay, here's the way I have to calculate the savings for Medicaid, and here's different from Medicare, and that's different from this health plan or the state health insurance population. And so we've brought together as part of this a multi-payer group to say, where can we start doing aligning things so it make it easier for providers to participate? And finally, and this is, I say finally, but this is, I think, a really fundamental part, that we want this not just to be about providers and patients, but we really wanted to have communities involved, and communities that represented, you know, other parts of the not community organizations that weren't just healthcare, but that really were so many of the parts that help improve health. So everything from faith organizations to mental health providers, long-term care providers, public health, friends in public health.
Commissioner, we have a question from Representative Grunhagen.
I can wait till she's done presenting.
Okay.
I've just got a couple more slides. I'm going to turn the ending over to Commissioner Ellinger. So what are we testing? So this is a model where we are testing this model. And so these are kind of the three big parts, and they really build upon each other. So the first part is, across 3 years, can we show that we both improve health and lower costs if more people in Minnesota are covered by kind of what we call these accountable care organizations or total cost of care models? So a different payment model that changes the incentive for providers. And so we're starting with a kind of target for the Medicaid population, but as I said, really looking through alignment with other payers to have this be beyond just the public program. So that's kind of the first piece. And then the question is, if we do that, can we even have better quality and lower the cost more if we provide more technology, data analytics, practice facilitation, basically if we give more tools to providers across our state so that they can engage in these models. So for an example, it's hard to be, if you're hard to agree to be accountable for population health if you're not getting data about what's happening to that population. If you can't look at it and say, here's someone that's going to the emergency room five times in a month. Here's someone that has diabetes and isn't using primary care. So we needed to make sure that we were able to help, and we'll talk about this some more through our RFPs, making sure that we had more of that data available and the data analytic capability so providers, including, as I said, those smaller and rural providers, not just the large organizations, could actually participate. So to better outcomes if we have more in these new payment arrangements. Can we further those better outcomes and lower costs if we have more tools? And then finally, can we get better health outcomes and costs if we've involved the community in a robust way? And make so it's so that when we're looking at this, we're involving all those parts of our communities that including those that are in not just the medical services, but the other parts as well. And that's where, and Ed will talk a little bit more about this too, we're piloting kind of 15 what we call accountable communities for health. We'll be giving funding for communities that want to come and say, we want to be part of this. And we brought together a lot of community partners that want to work with provider organizations to really move towards better patient outcomes and lowering costs. So that's what we're testing. These are some of the ways that we think we can get there, that we put in the grant. So changing those payment models I talked about, helping facilitate practice and learning collaboratives, and to have more coordinated care. As I said, we've got a really good start here in Minnesota. We can do more, including more with kind of some of these new workers, community health workers, community paramedics, really integrating more of that so we have more coordinated care, giving more of that HIT and data ability that's also really usable. And we're starting to do this at DHS with the folks that are already our partners in their Medicaid ACOs, where we're giving them regular data that they can analyze and that can be used by clinicians, not just by kind of people in back offices. And that we start in these accountable care organizations not to actually move beyond just the kind of more traditional healthcare side, to start at least taking steps towards integrating with long-term care, with social services and public health, because some of our most costly and greatest need clients need help across these systems. And finally, as I said, really to build much stronger community partnerships through our accountable communities for health. So that's kind of the steps we see taking, and I'm really going to turn it over to Ed to talk about, you know, some of the pieces of, well, what might that look like in 2 or 3 years if we're successful, and kind of some of our next steps in getting there.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunhagen, you have a question now.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if before she makes the change, could I ask a couple of questions?
Sure.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Jessen, for the presentation. A couple things. I had a phone call, so I stepped out for just a minute. My understanding is Minnesota is getting a $45 million grant. Is that a one-year grant? Here it says $60 million in your presentation. Could you clarify that for me?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, yes. We applied for close to $60 million. We got $45 million, and that's really across 3 years.
Across 3 years?
Yes. So the $45 million spread across 3 years, not $45 million a year.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Commissioner Jessen, my understanding is that we already have a Minnesota Community Measurement Group with representatives from the hospitals, doctors, and from the health plans that already is doing this on a private basis, and now we want to shift it over to the government and spend about a third of that $45 million on staff and administration, and now we're going to do all types of IT work, which we've just seen how the government does the IT work with Minsure, which is less than impressive, okay? So I have a concern that, you know, we've already got something that's working, that has produced some good results as far as the information I've received, and now we want to put them out of business and they're closer to the doctor-patient relationship. They're more experts on this area, and now we're going to go shift it over to bureaucracy and spend money on bureaucrats coming up with one-size-fits-all solutions, which we've seen how Obamacare and MnSures worked real well in that area, okay? I mean, that's my concern, is that this private organization can do just what you're doing, keep the information private, and not have all the shortcomings and fallacies of the government system, which we've already seen operating. How would you respond to that?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative. Let me just say, you mentioned community measurement. I think that is a real community resource. And, you know, I don't think they do all of what we're doing here. And I would also say that a lot of the money, most, you know, there is some money for overseeing all this, and there's some money for evaluation. But a large portion, I think we've got a slide on this, of these funds is going out to, through RFPs to communities, to, you know, and organizations, for an example like Community Measurement and other organizations, I think will probably be responding to those RFPs and asking for some of that work. So this isn't, this is very much a try and on these IT funds and this, some of the design work, a lot of this is to make that available to provider organizations so that they can be able to be part of these new models. So I think we're really trying to, I think, build upon what you are very correct is a lot of the success we have here in Minnesota.
Ms. Chair?
Representative Gruenhagen.
Yeah, thanks for that comment. But, you know, in my district, I've talked to a head nurse in one of our local hospitals. I've talked to doctors, talked to CEO administrators of a hospital. I've got two relatives that work at Rochester Mayo Clinic. Mm-hmm. None of them have a positive view of Obamacare or MnSure. Zero. Okay? All it's going to do, in fact, I just talked to a head nurse, she's a client of mine, and she said, all you're doing is taking money away from the doctor-patient relationship and growing hospital administration and bloated government bureaucracy. That's what she said. She said, that's not going to help. They're going to come up with one-size-fits-all solutions, and they're going to make things worse and not better. Now, again, this wasn't one medical personnel. This is everyone I've talked to, okay? They've all said the same thing. And some of my relatives work in the IT department, Rochester Mayo Clinic. He said, this is a mess. They want to know everything we're doing, and then they're going to come down and tell us what, if, when, and can we do this. So you have a lot of fine-sounding language in this, but when I look at your track record, it's a mess, okay?
Representative Gruenhagen, we're not talking about Obamacare or MnSure today. This is a program that's designed to go to the healthcare providers and ask them what is the best thing they can do to save money and improve the quality of care. That's what this thing is about. It's not about Obamacare or MnSure.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And my only comment there is I'm just bringing up Obamacare and MnSure as a contrast to how government works when they work with IT and personal information, and how they come with one size. So I'm not bringing it up as part of it. I'm bringing it up as an example of the fallacy of the fine-sounding words that are in this program. It's just simply going to produce worse results and not met.
Well,
not
Representative Gruenhagen, we have the highest cost health care in the world, and we're ranked about 28th in the quality of healthcare. So the current system we have is not working, and if we don't change something, for whether it's government or the healthcare providers, we're going to wreck our economy. So, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, if I may add one comment to what you just said, just to differentiate. I mean, the foundation of what we're doing here in the SIM grant is really built upon our Medicaid ACOs, and those are voluntary arrangements. No one's required to do them, but I would say that already six of our large provider organizations have said, we want to contract with you, the state, to try and have a different model. And, you know, those are like CentraCare and Essentia, you know, North Memorial, Children's Hospitals, our FQs, and Align and Health Partners in a partnership. And we're going to announce two more. These are voluntary arrangements. You know, so I don't think this is forcing anyone, but I think they're voluntary arrangements. They're hopefully 3 years, but we had all of our original six partners just say, we want to do this again for the second year. And I think that's because it's something that they believe is working. So that's, I just want to differentiate as far as the one size fits all. I think this is something that we're offering and providers are interested in.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Allen.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ed Ellinger, the Commissioner of Health, and thank you for this opportunity to talk about the state innovation model. And I'll pick up where Commissioner Jessen left off, but I want to highlight the fact that that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation are really looking for new ways of approaching healthcare that actually meet the needs of people in their communities. They recognize that if we continue to invest in a medical care system that, as the chair mentioned, is the highest cost in the world with poor outcomes, if we continue to do that, we're not going to get to the places where we want to be. So they're really looking for different ways to meet that triple aim of improved population health, reducing costs, and improving the patient experience. And they're looking to the states for suggestions on how to do that. And certainly that is one of the reasons why they're contracting, granting Minnesota, because they've seen what we've done here on a community level, on a whole variety of areas, looking at health more broadly. And that's why they were really encouraging us not to design something, but actually to test something, to really move forward with what we've been doing in the state for many years, particularly with all of the innovations that were put in place in 2008. They saw that we really had the building blocks to build a system here that we could demonstrate really improve population health, reducing costs, and improving the patient experience. Also, this came about, as Commissioner Jessen mentioned, by multiple meetings with many dozens of organizations throughout the state who have been engaged in health care, from consumers to providers to hospitals to health plans to citizen groups to private not-for-profit groups. Faith-based communities, really multiple meetings, really saying what do we want to test, what do we want to move forward. And so what we're putting together here is really a community effort to do that. And as Commissioner Jessen pointed out, you know, we have a vision of what we want to do, and we have these building blocks that we are going to be using to try to get to that effort, recognizing that this is a three-year effort. And this is not going to resolve all of the issues in our state. This is going to give us some knowledge, some information, some direction on what works and what doesn't work, particularly as we get down to these accountable communities for health, which we'll get into in a little bit, that actually has local communities determining what their needs are and how to really invest in health as opposed to just paying for services. And this slide outlines the fact that we have a bunch of building blocks. You know, we really want to get people starting to increasing number of our population into total cost of care, where we're really looking at what is the whole population needs and what the costs are, and so that we can manage the entire system, not just individual diseases, and really focus on really something that works for the entire population. We want to make sure that the Medicaid population is enrolled in these ACOs so that care can be better managed, more integrated. We really want that primary care effort, the healthcare homes and the behavioral healthcare homes that are being developed, that really is primary care based. It's based on team approach. It's been demonstrated that you can actually reduce costs, you can improve patient experience, particularly for those who have high risk, high needs, high cost care. We're a leader in the country in that. People are really looking at our healthcare homes as a way of actually doing that primary care in a way that's really cost effective. We certainly also recognize that our costs are not just the physical health, but also a lot of the behavioral health issues. So in that bottom corner on the left, we really are trying to say we really need to integrate primary care and long-term care and behavioral health in social service. We need to integrate that in a way that is really effective and leverage the resources and the expertise in all of those areas. And certainly we need to recognize that healthcare and medical care is in the context of the community. So we want to really link the providers in the community with the community needs. And so we're finding new ways to deepen those relationships between the providers and the community, getting input from the community on what the needs are, and so that the healthcare system can address those. We're looking at certainly quality measures because we want to know what works. We need to evaluate what's working and what's not working. So a lot of what we're doing is really about evaluating the approaches that we're taking. And in the middle of this is these accountable communities for health. We're building all of these around because we're going to be developing those 15 accountable communities for health to really say, how do we integrate the health care into all of the other health and human services that are in that community, along with the education and housing and other things that actually impact health? How do we make it into a way that we can leverage all of those, that they can learn from each other? And that's what these accountable communities for health are going to try to do. And as Commissioner Jessen pointed out, this is a $45 million grant over 3 years. And obviously, that's, I mean, $45 million is a lot of money, but over a three-year period with the kinds of goals that we have, we're going to, I hope, make some good progress. But this is not going to resolve all of the issues, and it's not going to answer all of the questions. But it really certainly will get us a long way. And you can see where these dollars are going to be invested. A lot of it is going to be on health IT and health information exchange and data analytics, because the data are in being able to share the data through all of the providers, through all of the community, and actually use the data in an effective way, not just having the data there without being able to use it. This is, will allow us to get data, exchange data, analyze the data so that we can use it for practice transformation, for developing approaches to improving health. And so you can see where the dollars are going to be going. And you'll probably be hearing things recently, because we are now in the phase, we're in the midst, now 3 months into our first year. We had 6 months of planning for the first 6 months now, starting in October of last year. We are in our first year, and we'll be coming out with some RFPs, particularly now related to the health information and technology and the health information exchanges. And so we'll be having three RFPs coming out. First, for the community e-health exchange grants. These are for collaborative activities where we really want to have the clinicians reach out beyond their borders, their boundaries, to community providers and other providers, so that they can share some of that information to allow better care to the population that they're serving. We're also developing some roadmaps for behavioral health, social services, really trying to find some ways to integrate that. And then we're certainly looking at privacy, security, data management, so we're dealing with all of the legal issues that surround any time you're dealing with the data. So you'll be seeing some of those grants coming out probably within the middle to the end of February with our first grant. We're also having data analytic contracts to support our integrated health partnerships, these Medicaid ACOs, so that we really can analyze. We have lots of data. We've not used the data in the most effective way. We've certainly used it well, but I think we can do more with that. And also using this contract to really do some baseline assessment of our accountable care organizations. And then we'll also be having some dollars for that practice and community transformation area, really helping providers to really integrate their activities, having learning collaboratives, because this is going to be a new way of working collaboratively in communities. We need to find ways to have the communities engaged in this process, so we're going to be doing some community outreach, community engagement, so that local communities know what we're trying to get at, how they can really play a role, how we can use the resources, the expertise, and the knowledge that they have. And so we'll be supporting a lot of that as we start to build for these accountable communities for health, where we take our ACOs, our total cost of care arrangements, our health information activities, which is going to be sharing information across different sectors, and then having the community have some ownership and responsibility for helping to decide how we're going to invest our dollars in those communities for the needs that are there. And this is where it's really exciting, because these accountable communities for health will be different size and different locations and have different approaches. This is a testing model, so we're going to test different models to see how that goes. So where are we now? We are in the midst of those RFPs, but we've also been really looking at getting information. We've set up two community advisory task forces, or two task forces. One was a community advisory task force, really looking at how do we get community engagement, how do we provide direction for our works with the communities throughout the state, how do we get that community input, really looking at overall population health improvement, how to integrate medical care, public health, social service, behavioral health. And then we have a multi-payer alignment task force with, we have members from the commercial and public payers really saying, how do we come together to really leverage the dollars that we have in a coordinated system so that we make the best use of that? And I've been really impressed with these two task forces, that they are really looking at the work that we've done over many years in this state, and you seeing that as a core, and how do we move it forward? How do, they're really looking at trying to find new ways to get at the fact that, you know, we spend a lot of money, but we don't have the best outcomes that are possible. How do we do that better? And how do we partner with each other? How do we coordinate with each other? How do we collaborate with each other in doing that? And how do we engage the community in this process? You'll be seeing some communications. We have a new website that is up explaining all of our information, and we've got staff now that are coming on board to help with this. And we will be continuing with our task forces and really working over the next year to expand our Medicaid ACOs and develop our accountable communities for health that we will kick off in October of this year. So with that, I'm open for questions. I'm sure Commissioner Jessen is open. We also have staff from our SIM program here. If you get too technical questions for us, we can bring those on board, but certainly open for questions.
Let me ask a couple to start. Either one of you can answer, but this is supposed to be a multi-payer organization, so it's not just medical assistance. It's you know, which is while it's very important, it's a smaller percentage of what let's say a hospital does compared to what they get paid for from insurance companies. So how are you getting the other groups involved in this?
Mr. Chair, that's an excellent question, and I think that's why, as Commissioner Ellinger was saying, our multi-payer task force is so important. And you'll notice that even on one of the building the vision blocks, one of the things we're trying to say, how will we know if they're successful, is that if it's not just that we want 200,000 Medicaid enrollees in these total new models, but we actually have a goal of having 60% of our fully insured population involved in some total cost of care new model. And we've already been reaching out to kind of the plans to try and figure out, okay, how many people are in one of those today, so that we have a baseline and know what we need to do to move forward. And that's where we really are working closely with not just public, but all the private payers on this as well. You know, and I think when we talk, and those arrangements, of course, can look very different. You know, the total cost of care, we're not saying they all have to look alike, but I think the more we can align some things, the easier it is going to be for providers to want to be part of this. And for an example, just even something as simple as how we report information back to providers. If we're able, I mean, we do that in one way in the Medicaid organization through our Medicaid ACOs. You know, other payors do it in a different way. If we could align so that we're giving them information so they can read it in the same way, that is kind of one example of alignment, which will make it easier for providers to do this. I really look at how we, in our state, have quality measures. Through often working with community measurement, as Representative Guggenhagen pointed out, that are very aligned in our SQRMS data, and how I think that the fact that we have alignment around quality and standardization means everyone's willing to do it more. And that's really what we're trying, our goal here as well.
Mr. Chair, certainly I think our multi-payer alignment task force has been really impressive to me in that they really are interested in aligning what they're doing. As Commissioner Jessen pointed out, they'd like to have some similar kinds of processes, similar kinds of access to information so that they can really work in a uniform way because they all have the same goals. And so I think that we're going to see some good innovation here around the multi-payer approach.
And my next question is, what is the role of insurance companies, the health plans, in this system? Since most of what you're doing, it seems to me, is going directly to the providers.
Mr. Chair, let me address that. And as far as what we're doing within our with our Medicaid population, since that's kind of our foundation here. And so what we're... In these contracts that we have with these large provider organizations that I had talked about earlier, what we agree with them is they are accountable for a certain population, and we attribute that population to them. And then we kind of say, here's what that cost would look like for that population on a risk-adjusted basis. If you come in below, we'll share those savings with you. But in further years, if you're taking on some risk too, but you don't get any of that money unless you meet the quality measures we agree on. So we have those contracts, and they vary by provider organization because we want this, as I was saying, it's voluntary, and different parts of the state are different. Okay, so the money, I think part of the question is what, you know, how does the money flow? And from our perspective, we want the money to flow to those providers according to our arrangement, whether those providers are being paid, but whether that patient they're seeing is in our fee-for-service system or in our managed care system. So what we've done at the Medicaid agency is saying, is to say to the health plans, we want this money for our PMAP families to flow to providers through the PMAP contracts or through our fee-for-service system, so that providers not having to say, oh, wait, you know, for a Medicaid enrollee, this only applies if they're in fee-for-service or only in managed care. We're making the money flow through them both ways. I guess I can only speak for myself right now, but I think that's as far as how other, payers are doing it, but I think that's part of the discussion at the multi-payer task force.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm still trying to absorb sort of the model. I like the goals, but I'm not quite sure I understand sort of practically how it works. And my understanding is that it's not just to deal with our public paid programs, but to look at the entire health system. Over half the state's population lives in the metro area. I can't see how this model is going to work on a geographic basis within that, and I challenge you to kind of help us figure that out. In my area, which is just a tiny portion of Minneapolis, but it has 15 unique neighborhoods, but even if you just drill down to my block, the 50 households on that block face, I bet there isn't a single one of us that goes to the same clinic. My clinic happens to be in a different city. If I needed hospitalization, I would be taken to a hospital in a different city. There's no continuity of care even amongst the privately insured because, and maybe that will stabilize eventually, but businesses keep trying to get the bigger, better rate, and so people oftentimes change insurance companies every 2 years, and that means you have to change your clinic every 2 years. And the relationships, even within a clinic, I've been in the same system for a long time, and I haven't been able to have a provider for more than 5 years because they lay them off or they transfer them to another geographic area or whatever. And so I'm hoping that as you're trying to wrestle with this, you try and figure out how to really make it work within the complexity that so many of us live in that is totally different than I could see this working in a rural community where all the clinics contract with all the health insurance companies, where you have stability in your provider base, where everybody goes to mostly the local hospital, and where there's an investment in the community. In the 15 neighborhoods that I represent, there isn't a single Boys and Girls Club, a YMCA or YWCA with fitness facilities. There's not a community center like suburbs have created with fitness facilities. There's community eds in between, school breaks. And so, I really would challenge you that if you want to create a model that works for Minnesota long term, that you really drill down and make it a point to say, we're going to make this model work in that complicated a community, because otherwise you're going to develop a model that I think isn't going to work with the realities of modern, private employer connections to insurance companies and how insurance companies, contract with one clinic 1 year and then they decide to drop them because they don't, or whatever. And so I want you to be successful, but I just want to say, please don't, in selecting communities, only select the easy ones, because there is no affinity in our area. And the models that have been successful at like this have been like Hennepin Health. But they're the community. It isn't geographic. It's the most expensive people are actually non-community. Many of them are homeless. Many of them are chemically dependent. It's a very successful model, but it isn't really related about place and community.
You want to respond?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, you raised a lot of really good issues, and I think these are some of the issues that this grant is going to try to address in a whole variety of areas. Certainly, looking at the total cost of care, we're building on the things that are already going on with the Medicaid ACOs, what the learnings are from that, and what more can we learn as we get more people into those, and how they get arranged will vary throughout the state, and people will be at various levels in a total accountable care or total cost of care arrangement. And so we're going to be testing some of those throughout the states in various areas. And particularly the accountable communities for health, which I think you're really looking at and talking about. We are still in the phase of what's accountable, what's a community, and really what's health, defining all of those. And these communities will come together in a variety of ways. Hennepin Health is one example of one approach. They've defined a community in a certain way. Throughout the state or throughout the country, where they've looked at hotspots, it might be a high rise in New Hampshire or New Jersey had a high rise as an accountable community for health. It might be based on a whole variety of affinities that where your employer is or your faith communities. We're looking at different models to say, which ones can we test? Which ones will give us the best example of how we might learn something in this state so that it would be workable in rural areas, in suburban areas, in urban areas, in small and large kinds of communities? That's what we're going to be testing with those 15 different approaches.
Okay. We have a number of people that have questions, and we're a little bit behind schedule, so we have to get out of here by about 11:30. Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is to the commissioners, whoever want to respond. Help me out a little bit, okay? I've had over 35 years of experience with the health insurance industry and health care, okay? And what I've observed during that period of time is that I will agree our health care system has problems, but 98% of the problems come from government, okay? And I'll just give you one quick example. Their underpayment of services creates cost shifting, which drives up health insurance premiums for the private sector by 30 to 40%. They've been doing it for years. And that's just one example. I could give you dozens of examples if you want me to. So here again, we see a private organization, the Minnesota Community Measurement Group, made up of hospitals, doctors, and health plans. And here we have government coming in with a grant, taking over part or all of their responsibilities and having all types of wonderful goals, which I applaud. But why should I not conclude, or any reasonable, rational person, after looking at government's involvement since 1965 in healthcare, that this simply is not going to make things better, regardless of the goals? It's going to make things worse. And therefore, why don't you work with the Minnesota Community Measurement? Forget this grant. The government's broke anyway at the federal level. And they will produce the data and the conclusions that might actually make a big difference in accomplishing the goals that you want. You want to respond to that?
Well, let me just comment before we turn it over to the commissioners. Community Measurement is a good organization. I strongly support it. But if you went and talked to those people, they'll tell you that the payment system has to change. Mm-hmm. And that's what this is about, changing what we pay for. And I've told a million times about Essentia in Duluth and St. Luke's in Duluth that reduced spending on people with congestive heart failure by 50%. Trouble is they lost money doing that because they couldn't get paid for what they did, because our payment system doesn't reward anybody for doing what's right. It just rewards for services. It does not reward for results. So I support community measurement, but this is a different approach aimed primarily at how we pay providers. Commissioners.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen. We are actually building on the work of Minnesota Community Measurement in this program. They are collecting a lot of information that we are really using for quality, for value, that we're using this as a way to evaluate it. This program actually will change the delivery system. It'll also enhance folks in getting data and using data, which will allow them actually to measure what's going on. So this will help Minnesota Community Measurement do its work, which has been good work over the years, to really allow us to improve the quality and the value of care that's provided. So I think this is not about getting rid of community measurement, actually using community measurement and the work that they do as part of analyzing, assessing, and making this SIM grant work.
Follow. Make a brief vote.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, well, I would simply advise you to talk to them, because I talked to one of the representatives, and they're of the opinion you're trying to put them out of business, okay? So I appreciate your comment, but I'd say communicate with them more directly, or maybe if you have, but to make it clear that you want to work with them rather than to undermine them, because one of the representatives in talking with me seemed to indicate that the new contract coming out had provisions in it to make it very difficult for them to exist anymore in the future.
Representative Abler.
Oh, thanks, and I wish we had more time, but I just, I've been in every health reform thing we've had in the state for a long time, and as I listen to this, it seems fuzzy, and I just can't get over the fog of it all, and I just, you'll do whatever you want, and so I've learned that in my time here as well, but I do have some thoughts. Why, if we had $45 million, would we not try to integrate, like, community health clinics and public health, build on things we already have? Hennepin Health is supposed to be doing all this stuff now. And so our success in Minnesota is because we've learned, and we have gaps, and let's look at the gaps. If you put $2 million, we've tried to get $1 million or $2 million for community health clinics in particular, where they're starving. And we raised bars about making them have new credentialing, you know, to be health homes, and some can't even qualify for that because they can't afford the technology. And so we have some really innovative things in Minnesota that we do today. And now we're going to layer these little 15 groups, and I think you're on the wrong track. And I think that I regret telling you that we need to work on how we pay what we get. We agree on the goal, and I think Russell Loeffler kind of picked up on some of the stuff you're doing about how you have all these non-homogeneous neighborhoods. And, you know, talk to the Office of Rural Health. What do they wish they had that they could innovate and push into and to make it practical? Whenever there's a new project going on, we used to have a trout pond where I used to vacation. You'd throw the food out, and they would just, like, scurry over to eat the food. And here comes $45 million, and everybody wants to help get the spend the $45 million for you. But I think as you look at this, you want to make sure you got something at the end of the day that you really can go and have some concrete stuff. And I think that we love the outcomes. And we already have provider peer grouping. How's that going? I don't know. Everybody's afraid to touch it. But we've put all the effort and the embarrassment, and we're close to something coming out of that. So, And we already have SHIP that you guys are pretty excited about, you know, and what's the interaction with that and the regular public health? So I would, if you're looking for advice, if it's done, then go do it and spend $45 million. But I think if we looked at a gap analysis where we see what is missing in Minnesota to just get us across the finish line one more little bit. Having sat as the chair in 2011, I realized people now believe $45 million is a lot of money. That was, if there's any innovation that came out of that. It used to be $100 million was pocket change. So that's my advice to you as you go back into your groups. And for sure, I think you want to make sure we get a budget report about who actually got the money. And then we can say, what did you do with the money? And I'm supportive of your work. You have awesome departments dedicated toward improving the health of people. And that's just my thoughts. I guess it's a... They can react. I know you're short of time, Mr. Chair.
Okay, well, we have two more presentations after this one. But next we have Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Ellinger and Commissioner Jessen. Thanks for the work that you are doing in a tough time to do it. I appreciate what you guys are doing. When we're looking at the data and the data collection with this program, one of the things that kind of pops out is the privacy and security of the data that is collected. Could you just talk very briefly about what data that you're going to be looking for, how that's going to be collected, and how that will be protected?
Yes.
Commissioners.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we're starting with sharing data within the accountable care organization so that all the providers can share information from clinic to clinic, from hospital to clinic. We're also trying to find ways, just like we're doing with the Beacon Project in southeast Minnesota, where the people who really need to know about asthma care in the schools might be able to have some of that, that the school nurse can have some of the access to that information so that that school nurse can help with the asthma action plan that's in that that care organization or in that school for that individual. We're also seeing how we can get information shared between long-term care facilities and behavioral health facilities so that it actually gets when a provider is seeing a patient, they can have the information that is accurate for that or applicable for that individual from be it long-term care or the behavioral health home. Those are the kinds of information that we're really trying to share. We're also trying to share information about the population as a whole, some of the public health information, about what's the issues in the community that the provider knows the context in which that patient lives. You know, what's going on in terms of environmental issues within that neighborhood. Those are some of the things that we're doing, and certainly data privacy is one of the issues that we're really focusing on with our HIT activities.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And just to follow up, Commissioner, when we're collecting data about the health population of groups, it's always a very difficult thing to track and sensitivity towards different groups and communities around the state of Minnesota. And when we're looking at aligning that with payment, that also provides something beyond the $45 million. It's the implications are much, much bigger on a Medicaid delivery basis of billions of dollars across the state of Minnesota. How that money is going to be distributed is actually magnified many, many times larger when we're looking at how this money is going to be distributed henceforth. So we are very concerned about how that money is distributed and how the security and privacy of particular communities is number one asked about, number two received, number three what kind of information do we want, who are we asking it from, how is that being protected, and then how is that money being, how is that information being linked back to payment. Those are some pretty big questions that currently we are looking at, and also just to finish in as we're looking at this in technology, could this money be used in currently as kind of following on to some of the other representatives' questions, could this money be used in an area like Minsure where we are collecting data and where we are having difficulties within our IT system now? The average guy in the street would say that that's kind of a siren on top of that, and how could we perhaps use this money to fix that problem immediately?
Commissioners,
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, you know, under the terms of the grant, you know, we can't use this money to assist with Minsure, and I certainly am very cognizant of the challenges, the privacy challenges. I mean, in our Medicaid ACO now, you know, we're sharing information between providers in a, you know, a way that's very, you know, permissible and acceptable, and you know, there are clear rules around that. And I think one of the reasons our RFPs is to address some of the questions around if you're going to go and share more information, how would you do that in an appropriate way? How individualized should it be? What would be the protections if you did before we'd move anywhere in that realm? So, and I also would say that, you know, from the way I look at this is what when we're talking about kind of sharing some of this information to involve outside of just the, you know, hospital clinic, but maybe with mental health or long-term care, it is the question about how could we, you know, and we have to look at this carefully, share information between those providers, you know, as opposed to, you know, it's, you know, just the government taking in lots of information. We're really trying to facilitate those provider and organization sharing information to provide coordinated care to patients as opposed to, oh, we just want all this information. So I think it's a, but there's no question we have to tread carefully.
Okay, now we're going to go to Representative Liebling, and then, that'll be the last one. Then we have two other presentations that we have to get through today. So, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I take the hint. A lot of interesting things have been said here by members, and I think it's been a really good discussion. Thank you for the presentation, which I think is really helpful. I'm going to narrow my question down to just ask you, what pieces of this have to come to us for legislative change, if anything?
Commissioners.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, there's nothing that we've identified at this point that requires legislative approval. I mean, certainly we already have the authority to do these accountable our Medicaid ACOs. I think that may change depending on as we move forward and get more input from the task force, or if we see that there needs to be different laws on, you know, for example, around the data, depending on what we learn. So I think there could be. I don't think there's anything that I've identified right now, but I do actually say agree with I think several of the comments here, including those made by Representative Abel, that I think kind of reports, you know, to all of you about, you know, how we're doing, how is the money being spent, you know, kind of regular reports would be, I think, from my perspective, very advisable, and certainly would like to do that.
Okay, well, we have to move on, so thank you, commissioners, for your presentation. And we're going now to talk about the bonding proposals from the Department of Human Services. And all the presentations that are on the handouts are also on our website for this.
Will be.
Okay. So, Deputy Commissioner Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chuck Johnson, Deputy Commissioner for Policy and Operations for the Department of Human Services. Thanks for the opportunity to present today on the bonding proposal that the governor has included in his bonding request released a couple weeks ago. Do you have a time box on how quickly you want me to do this, or?
10 minutes, maybe.
Okay. We can do that.
10:15.
Staff is handing out the PowerPoint that I'll be displaying above as well. The first slide here just gives you an overview of the bonding proposal. For those of you, I think, I can't remember if we presented to this committee, but I know we talked to a number of folks on this committee last year. It's a modification of the proposal we had last year, but the basic thrust of it is the same, really focused on the St. Peter campus as our top priority, both the security hospital and the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. These proposals are listed in priority order, so the security hospital first, then the sex offender program. We're also requesting $4 million in asset-wide preservation. I'll talk a little bit about where that money will go. And then finally, early childhood learning facilities, requesting $3 million in that area. You'll see that the security hospital and St. Peter and the MSOP proposals on the St. Peter campus are phased, two phases for the security hospital and three for the sex offender program. I'll talk a little bit more about that, but they are multi-year projects that would require some commitment going forward, although in the case of the sex offender program, those phases can be handled independently depending on what other things are going on within that program that may affect the number of beds that we need going into the future in the sex offender program. There are four priorities that we're trying to address with this proposal for the St. Peter campus. Create a safer and more therapeutic treatment environment for the security hospital for the patients. I'll go through and address a couple of things that we're trying to accomplish there to make this a better environment for patient care. Our hope is that out of this, we expect we can reduce the length of stay that people have at the security hospital. That's currently about 8 years. We'd like to reduce that to 6 years, and we believe by working within a better physical environment, we can accomplish that reduction in stay. Also creating a safer working environment for our staff. We've had a number of issues with staff injuries over time. This proposal will hopefully address that from a physical plant standpoint. Physically separating vulnerable adults from predatory populations. For those of you that are familiar with the St. Peter campus, there is an upper campus and a lower campus, and in between the two is the bluff of the Minnesota River. Currently on the lower campus, we have a variety of buildings, and some of those buildings are used by the sex offender program, and some of the buildings are used by the security hospital for patients who are committed to us as mentally ill and dangerous. We're mixing on that lower campus two populations, one of which are vulnerable adults, those who are mentally ill, and one of which are committed to us as sexual predators or sexually dangerous persons. That's not a good population mix to have in the same geographic place. What this proposal will do is separate those populations such that the security hospital, its programming, its buildings will be on the top of the hill, where the big security hospital building is now, leaving the lower campus available for the sex offender program to increase the number of beds on that campus to the extent we need to going forward. So that's really what's accomplished in the long term over the three phases of this proposal. And then finally, part of the proposal is really designed to help create some flexible capacity going forward in beds for the sex offender program. We're still projecting going forward 50 to 60 new sex offenders joining the Minnesota sex offender program each year. That's based on our current estimates from what we see in the correction system and the commitment patterns that have been ongoing. That could be changed with different additional policy changes that I know are being contemplated, the recommendations from the task force and so forth, but right now that's the commitment that we see. The advantage that we get of building at St. Peter is that's where end-stage treatment is located for the sex offender program, and that's where we're going to need the capacity going forward, both because that's the way the population is moving, but also because that's where the legal pressure is to have more capacity for end-stage treatment. So we believe St. Peter needs to be part of what we're doing going forward, regardless of any of the policy decisions that are made. But also, as I said, we have separate phases built in here which are separable, and we can make new decisions each year based on what our new projections look like and based on any policy changes that are influencing that going forward. I won't spend a lot of time on this slide in the interest of time, but this gives you an overview again of the dollars that are involved. We did get about $3.6 million in 2012 for pre-design and design. We've been using that money to help get a better design for the security hospital program, have construction documents now that we're in the process of releasing. We would be able to put the security hospital project out to bid this spring were it approved by the legislature and signed off on by the governor. We've also added in the sex offender program in the first phase some additional beds in the Sunrise building. I'll talk a little bit more about that. That's an addition from where we were last year. Phase one for the security hospital really tries to accomplish two things. First is to get accomplished as quickly in the first phase as we can the pieces of the work in the security hospital that we believe will help the most acute patients that are in that setting. And this really focuses in phase one on a new secure 4-bed evaluation unit and a 12-bed crisis unit. The evaluation unit will give us a separate place for folks who are first coming in, first committed to us and coming into security hospital, so that we can work with them in a separate environment to help stabilize their treatment, figure out which meds they need and so forth before we move them into the general population. We think that's really important to have a separate place to be able to handle these new folks who come to us new, just keep them separate from the general population. Similarly, the 12-bed crisis unit, when we have patients who are in the general population who go into a crisis, we need to be able to separate them from the general population because that crisis is disruptive not only to the person that's having the crisis but also to the other patients in the general population. We don't have a good way to do that now. This would give us a secure crisis bed, 12 beds that we could use for patients that are in crisis as a way to address those issues. The other thing that the first phase of the project does is really start moving the security hospital patients off of the lower campus so we can start then remodeling those buildings for the sex offender program in phase two. So one of the things that we do in this first phase is we construct 48 beds of transitional housing on the upper campus, which allows us to vacate part of the Bartlett building on the lower campus. This gives you a diagram of the upper campus. The building that's in gray at the bottom of the slide here is the existing security hospital building. What's shown in white here is what would be built in phase one, and the dotted lines are the things that we built in phase two. Phase one is a little bit more of the new construction. Phase two is more renovation and remodeling within the existing gray building that's at the bottom of the slide there. So that's how it's staged, in a sense, to do the new construction to give us the flexibility to move people around that we need in order to do the renovation in the second phase, because obviously we'll be doing that with patients still in the hospital.
Mr. Johnson.
Yes.
We're going to... The next presentation we're going to hold off until some future date. So, Lauren Coleman, you can wait till sometime later, and so, Mr. Johnson, you have a little bit more time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you want me to slow down, or should I keep moving at this speed? Mr. Chair, the slide that's up now shows you phase two for the security hospital. As I mentioned, based on funding being available, this would be requested in 2016. We'd be able to begin early in the fall of 2016. This is where we get more into that existing security hospital building and starting to do more of the remodeling of that facility itself, remodeling the living units. One of the things that we'll be doing, I'll show you the next slide. I think folks have seen this before. We've used it a couple of years. This is a slide that shows you a picture of the living units, one of the living units within the security hospital. And you can see the split levels, the poor sight lines, the narrow staircases. All of those contribute both to making it difficult for staff to monitor what patients are doing, but also contribute to an environment where patients don't necessarily always feel safe because they don't know what's around the next corner, who's down at the bottom of the stairs, because you can't see what's going on. In the second phase, these split units, or some of these split units, will be essentially made into a single-story flat unit with good sight lines, and I'll show you. This slide shows you our Anoka facility, the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, which gives you a much better idea of what a modern treatment setting should look like, secure treatment setting, wide hallways, good lighting, a nurse's station that has good visibility up and down the hall so they can see what's going on, common patient areas that are near to the nursing station again so there's some visibility to what's going on. Similarly, this is an Avera facility that our staff visited in South Dakota that is also a secure mental health facility. And again, you can see the difference between that and if you look at what we have now for the living facilities within the security hospital, it's really a dramatic difference in terms of the kind of facility that we want to have for our patients moving forward. So, Mr. Chair, I'll just turn then and talk about, the sex offender program and what we propose to do in the first phase of that project. I'm on slide 11 for those of you that are trying to track where I'm at. The governor recommends $7.4 million for the sex offender program on the St. Peter campus in 2014. A portion of this, about a little over a million, is for the pre-design and design for future phases of the project. $6.3 million is for remodeling the west wing of the Green Acres building, the east wing of the Sunwise building. This will provide 60 new beds for MSOP. When we had the proposal last year, we had the Green Acres with 30 beds. We didn't have the Sunrise, but as our bed pressure continues to grow, we need to have the beds online more quickly because, of course, a year delay of having not gotten the proposal funded last year. We are expecting 50, 60 new sex offenders to come to the program each year going forward. And right now, we're set to run out of beds in the spring of 2015. And in addition, we have about 100 clients who are currently sharing rooms. So we have significant bed pressure within the program as it currently sits. This shows you what the lower campus would look like after the phases were done for the sex offender program, kind of a conceptual design. The buildings that are kind of to the right there look like two E's put together, I guess, those are the existing sex offender program buildings, the Pexton and Chance building. Chance was remodeled through a bonding request a few years ago, so folks may recall that one. The buildings that currently have some security hospital patients in them are Bartlett Hall, which looks similar to those buildings but is toward the lower left-hand side of the slide, and then those two three-prong buildings, which are Sunrise and Great Acres at the bottom of the slide. So those are the buildings we're moving folks out of. Oh, I'm sorry, as well as Johnson Hall, which is the blue building way up on the upper right side of the slide, also has security hospital patients in it now. Those are the places we would be moving folks out of and moving them up to the top of the hill in order to create space on the lower campus for end-stage treatment for the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. As I said, there are two more phases planned for the St. Peter campus for the sex offender program. These phases can be handled independently, so as we get past 2014, if there are changes made to the program in terms of commitments or alternative living arrangements and so forth, we can reassess what we need in 2016 as we go toward 2016. The assumptions that are built into the proposals here for 2016 and 2018 are based on our current law expected 50 to 60 new clients coming to the program a year. So you can see that the phase two has renovation of the Bartlett building, the Tomlinson building. Tomlinson is more for a common programming area. Bartlett is for living space. And then ultimately in 2018, some more work on Sunrise and Green Acres for some common space within those buildings that would be used by the program.
Commissioner Johnson, just a question. Which one of these buildings is currently for a nursing care nursing home level of care?
Mr. Chair, that's the building that's at the top of this slide. Okay. It's slide six. That's the secure nursing facility, which I think was constructed in the mid-2000s, if I remember correctly.
Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks for the presentation, Commissioner Johnson. Say one of the things, when I was on the school board, one of the things I'd always say when we were looking at a building project is, give me the per square foot cost, okay? Because what that does, it gives a layperson like myself a piece of information that you can then go to research and say, compare this per square foot cost with what other states are doing in a similar area. And it sees if we're getting a good deal for the taxpayer expense. And it's an excellent presentation that you put together, but from a representative and layperson standpoint, I found that information to be very valuable when assessing school projects and finding out what other schools had done in the state or even in neighboring states and what their expenses were. And that data, can help us hone in on and hopefully create an efficiency in spending taxpayer dollars. Any thoughts on that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Grunhagen, I have a per square foot cost from 2013. I don't know if this has changed with the new proposal.
Is it in here?
It's not in here. Okay. I can give it to you, but I think it might be helpful too, just to give the whole committee updated numbers on that, and I can have staff work on that. The 2013 number was a project square foot cost of $319 per square foot. We also did a comparison. Representative Dean asked a similar question, I think, in 2012. We did some comparisons to some other secure hospital facilities that have been built, and we can share that with the committee as well to see how this project compares to those other projects.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Johnson. Look forward to looking at receiving that information.
Commissioner Johnson.
Mr. Chair, shift gears a little bit to talk about our third priority, which is asset preservation. The governor is requesting $4 million for DHS asset preservation. I think folks are familiar with asset preservation. It really goes to keeping the buildings that we have in good shape, so we're deferring, and running into deferred maintenance and problems going forward. These dollars will be targeted at four of our big campuses, Anoka, Brainerd, MSOP, and Moose Lake, and then the St. Peter campus as well.
Can I ask you a question about the Brainerd campus? Because I drive by that probably once a week, and most of it's gone now.
Mr. Chair, it is true it's a much smaller campus than it once was.
And treatment center has been torn down. But there's still, isn't that the office for Minnesota Care?
That's right, Mr. Chair. We have a number of our Minnesota Care workers in the northern office that are located in the Brainerd campus. Mr. Chair, so these are roof replacements, abatement of asbestos, floor coverings in different buildings, caulking, re-caulking, nip-tucking, new elevator in a building. It's a variety of different projects that make up to $4 million. I think the key objective here is for us to not get in a position where our older buildings are having problems that is creating further costs down the line. We keep a regular running list of the projects that we have and prioritize those on a regular basis. Right now we have about $21 million $1 million of asset preservation projects. And so you'll see on the first slide, if you go back to the first slide, we're requesting $4 million through each bonding phase to keep up with that list and try to keep ourselves up with that list and try to keep ourselves ahead of those problems with our older buildings. Mr. Chair, the final proposal that we have for bonding is a governor's recommendation for $3 million for statewide grants that help local entities to renovate and renew standard or older buildings for early childhood facilities. These are grants that have been put in place several times over the last decade by the legislature. It's a little bit different than traditional bonding in that it's done through an RFP process that the department manages. It's largely school districts and to some extent other local governments who make applications. Those applications are often for a multitude, though, of community partners who have come together to look at some space that they might want to renovate for early childhood programming, often in an old school building or other old community building in the community. They're also required to be matched 50% with non-state funds. So this is something that, again, relatively rare in bonding, where we ask the locals to put dollars in as well. We had, the last time we did this, about three times as much in grant requests as we had in dollars to put forward, so we know that the pressure is there. One of the other pressures that's been added here is all-day kindergarten, which has put some pressure on space for a number of school districts, and in some cases that has been started to put pressure, push out some of the early childhood programming, which then kind of tumbles down where they need some additional help putting that early childhood programming space back in place in their communities. I put up a map that shows for the last about 20 years the 68 sites where we provided funding. So that has been a variety of different bonding cycles, not on a regular basis, but sporadically the legislature has provided money for this activity. We are requesting going forward that there be $3 million provided in each bonding cycle for this function. We continue to see the need. I think at the point that change, we might reconsider. But at this point, we're continuing to see the interest from the communities, the need in the communities, and we think it's helpful to have the dollars to make early childhood programming work around Minnesota.
Representative Norton.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And this is an area that I've always had a lot of interest in. So I just had two quick questions. One is, you're defining early childhood and kindergarten separately. They're not one and the same, so this money couldn't be used for those districts who need to expand for kindergarten. Am I correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Norton, that's correct.
And so, to your knowledge, we're not offering any other help to districts who don't have room for the kindergarten expansion?
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, I don't know the answer to that. I could try to find out. It would be more a question for people in education.
Yeah, so I'm seeing this as sort of a perhaps a backdoor way to address that need for some districts, and I was wondering about how you would prioritize if districts need to expand for kindergarten, and by accessing some of this funds, would they be given a higher priority perhaps through the RFP process? So you may not know the answer to that right yet, but those would be some thoughts I would have. And then also I wondered about special education. Because we're a birth to three state, we also provide early childhood special education, and how would that program and perhaps grants from federal funds be able to be used as a 50% match, or would they be able to be used?
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, I'm not sure to what degree or extent these dollars could be used for special education, so I'm looking to my help in the audience to see if I can get an answer.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Francie Mathis, Department of Human Services.
Get the name again.
Francie Mathis, Department of Human Services. The special early childhood special ed programs are one of the programs that are frequently involved in the programming side of this, but there are not facility dollars associated with the early childhood special ed side to help.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Norton.
And so would those programs still qualify as part of the early childhood funding? So they would.
Yes, Mr. Chair, yes. They are part of that. The part of the prioritization is the collaboration. So we're always looking for more than one program to be part of the project. And typically, early childhood special ed is part of that, as well as early childhood screening, a number of other programs that fit that come together into the new renovated space.
And just as a follow-up, I sort of asked this question before, and if you don't know the answer, that's okay, but would there be any priority be given to districts who have the need for the all-day kindergarten space? Would there be a way that they could be perhaps prioritized in getting some of these grants so that they could move out?
Ms. Mathis.
Mr. Chair. The there are several priorities already in the law, and that is not one of them currently. But I think it also is relates to the pressure and the actual project and as it gets written. One of the priorities is for school districts with the greatest number of children in poverty. So it really has, in the past, been more for the districts that are serving children in poverty.
Well, not to keep the microphone going too much, but I would just encourage, as this process moves forward, there's some thought be given to that particular need, because the state has made in the last couple of years set the course for a direction for our school districts, and for many of them, they are. You know, a real problem. They would like to do it. They can't do it. And you are correct. Many of these districts are using building spaces. And I can speak to some very small communities as well as, you know, my own, which is a little bit larger. But I've been to rural Minnesota, and they are using some of their school buildings for their ECFE and other programming. And, as I said, early childhood special ed. And so if they need those spaces and this money could be used, to me, it makes sense that we consider that as one of the options. So it may need to be an addition or a change in the law to allow that to be part of the process. And if so, I would just encourage you to consider that, you know, as you move ahead. Thanks.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, that's it for the presentation. I take any other questions.
Okay. Any questions? I don't see any, so thank you, Commissioner Johnson,
you.
For your presentation. And with that, I'll adjourn the meeting.